Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
Good afternoon. Thank you for joining us on this hour of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. I want to open by saying Blessed Feast Day of the Annunciation of Our Blessed Virgin Mother to all of you. It is a joyous feast day for me for a lot of reasons. One of the first is I want to wish my darling bride a blessed engagement anniversary. We chose this feast day for a reason, obviously. But also on another level, more personal level, the words that Gabriel spoke to Mary, Hail Full of Grace, were the words that I studied as the final hurdle for me to become Catholic. And so I owe this feast day a particular debt of gratitude, so to speak. But as I mentioned personal reasons, there are a few things that we need to talk about. Like, first of all, the Feast of the Annunciation is, in fact, the celebration of the incarnation of our Lord and Savior. 9 months from today exactly is when we celebrate Christmas, and that's how the Church gives us the dating. But it is also the day that Tolkien made as the day that the One Ring was destroyed. And so as I read to my children from the good book, their favorite part is when Tolkien throws the ring into Mount Doom. And as much as I say that in jest, the fact of the matter is Tolkien was very explicitly Catholic about his expression of the Lord of the Rings narrative. And I'm going to be talking with Joseph Pierce soon about this. This isn't a segment you would want to miss. We won't be doing it today, though. Today, there are a few things we need to talk about. The first thing is Dr. Greg Popchak joins us to talk about finding the sweet spot of discipline when it comes to parents modeling virtue and calling out virtuous actions and behavior in our children, discipline and structure. We go on from there to speak with Richard Spinello. Richard is no stranger to this program. We want to talk about the 30-year anniversary of Evangelium Vitae, what we can learn from it, and what we still have yet to apply from the wisdom and the prophetic reality that John Paul II was calling us to in Evangelium Vitae. And finally, we speak with Rachel Fulton Brown. As we celebrate the solemnity of the Annunciation of Our Blessed Virgin Mother, we also get to explore the long history of the Church's devotion to Mary and her central position in salvation history and in the development of medieval liturgy. All of this we get to talk about after the headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Tuesday, March 25th. It's the solemnity of the Annunciation. Today's news brought to you by Ave Maria University. Your vocation location is at avemaria.edu. Democrats are seeking the resignations of top Trump administration officials after a reporter claimed he was added to a group text that discussed plans to strike Houthi targets in Yemen. It comes after U.S. intel chiefs testified before a Senate committee today and were grilled on the chat. The Atlantic's Jeffrey Goldberg says he first thought the group responded to a request on a messaging app.
And you say, yeah, sure, message me. And then the next thing you know, you're part of the PC Houthi small group, messaging group on Signal with Marco Rubio and Pete Hegseth and the head of the CIA.
Earlier, President Trump says he has confidence in these people, and he added he thinks National Security Advisor Mike Waltz, the person reportedly made that chat error, has learned his lesson. A Catholic nurse practitioner has reached a settlement in a religious discrimination case against CVS Pharmacy. She was fired last year for refusing to prescribe contraceptives or drugs that could cause abortions, and when patients sought such services, she would refer them to a different provider. A settlement was reached Friday for an undisclosed amount. Wildfires continue to burn in western North Carolina as three large fires are burning in Polk County, where at least 5,700 acres have been burned and several buildings have been destroyed. And one of the most notable players in women's college basketball will be sidelined for the remainder of the NCAA tournament. ESPN is reporting that USC star sophomore guard Juju Watkins suffering a torn ACL during the team's second-round contest and is set to undergo season-ending surgery. From your AveMariaRadio.net news desk, I'm Steve Clark.
Good afternoon, welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. Most parents tend to be either too tough and rigid or much too gentle in their discipline. Striking a balance between these two approaches is crucial. Being overly harsh can damage the parent-child relationship, but being too lenient can lead to a lack of discipline and structure. Dr. Greg Popchak helps us to find this quote-unquote sweet spot of discipleship discipline. Greg is no stranger to this program, founder and director of CatholicCounselors.com, a group pastoral telecounseling practice that provides help for Catholics dealing with personal issues. And he and his bride, Lisa, co-host More to Life, that is produced by Ave Maria Radio and EWTN, and they're the developers of the Catholic HOM app, a resource that helps Catholic families thrive. Greg, great to speak with you. How are you?
I'm doing well, Marcus. Great to be here.
I always enjoy our encounters, and I will say that as a parent of young children, this is a continuous tension, if you will, of developing the virtue of parenting and calling out virtue in children. So just frame this issue for us, secular parents.
Well, I think that there are, broadly speaking, there are three parenting styles, mm-hmm. right? There's the kind of permissive parenting style, then there's the more authoritarian parenting style, where you know you do what I say and, mm-hmm. and or else, and then there's an authoritative style, and the authoritative style is what we want to shoot for, mm-hmm. Because that allows us to be gentle in our approach but still be effective in teaching virtue and getting the outcomes from our kids that we need to see. I think too often, it's very easy to fall into one side or the other, and you know, right. That's okay. We're all, parenting is an on-the-job training kind of thing. We're all learning as we go. But we want to keep always aiming for that authoritative perspective where I'm not giving away my power on the one hand, but I'm also not lording my power over my kids, and instead really using that to bring out the best in them while trying to be my best self too.
And when we think about being our best selves so that we can model this virtue and call out the best selves of our children, but we can also admit in the messiness of daily life, we're not always going to be able to do that perfectly.
No, of course not. And I don't think that's the goal, really. I
right.
think that, you know, one of the things that we talk a lot about in our parenting books, that we talk about, that we coach parents to do on the Catholic HOM app, is the importance of kind of praying through things in the moment, we ideally with our kids, but certainly on our own. But being able to say, you know, okay, my child has done something that's pushing my buttons, that's aggravating me, I have to address it. Mm-hmm. You know, before I do anything, though, just offering up that quick prayer, you know, Lord, you know, help me be the parent my child needs me to be. Help me to show them your love, and help me to bring out the best in them too. And you know, then intervene or sit down with the kid and say, you know what, before we do anything about this, let's pray about this together. You know, Lord, you know, help me be the parent my child needs me to be. Help me to help him figure out what he's trying to do, and help him to do it in a good and godly way. Okay, let's talk about this. You know, and so we're putting ourselves in a place where we're recognizing that we don't know what we're doing, and that's
right.
Okay. You know, God does, and if we can just kind of take a breath. And create that little space for the Holy Spirit, if you will, to intervene, and kind of guide us through that. It makes a big difference, and it allows us to not let our emotions run the scenario for us, while on the other hand, not just avoiding dealing with it at all.
You know, you bring up an important point that you and I have spoken about in the past. For some reason, in modernity, we seem to think that the moment you get married, you're already an expert at being a husband or a bride. The moment you have a child, you're expected to be an expert at parenting. And the fact, or for boys and girls, that at some point you just kind of figure out how to be a man and a woman, and it's just expected. But the fact is, all of these things need to be modeled. Discipleship needs to be called out. And we ought not take any of these things for granted.
Well, no, that's absolutely true. And it's interesting, you know, this has been something that's been coming up a lot in our conversations with subscribers to mm-hmm. Catholic Home, that there are sort of two common mistakes that parents will make. And the first one is that we just kind of assume that given time, the child will pick certain skills or virtues or appropriate behaviors up. You know, my child doesn't sit at the table for dinner now, but if I just let him run around, you know, when they get a little older, they'll figure it out. They don't,
yeah.
But we often think that way. You know, if my child is a little impulsive now and maybe tends to kind of shoot off at his mouth, but if I just let it go, eventually he'll learn to be a little more respectful.
Yeah.
He won't, but you know, people think that. Now, on the other side of that, the sort of the flip side of the same coin is, if I just punish my child enough, the good behavior will kind of flick on like a switch, and they'll suddenly be able to do it.
Mm.
And that's again, the presumption is that good behavior is natural to the child somehow. It will either emerge on its own, or it will come out if I punish the bad behavior well enough. Neither of those things is true. Children don't know anything. You know, like you were saying, you know, we don't know how to be husbands and wives or moms and dads. Well, kids don't know how to be people, and we have to teach them everything, including how to listen and to obey. So, for example, one common way that parents might give away their power is, let's say I have a 3 or 4 or 5-year-old, and I'm saying, hey, I need you to do this. And the kid looks at me and says, no. Right? So then what do I do, right? Well, a lot of parents will try to negotiate with the kid, or they'll try to convince the kid to see the value in the lesson that they're trying to teach. And, you know, that's well-intentioned, but that's not going to work, you know, because they don't know how to obey. They don't know how to listen and follow through. But punishing them won't necessarily work either, because then they just learn that you're mad at them. So what do? Well, you say, okay, I need you to do this. They look at you and they say, no. So then you pick them up and you move them to the thing that you need them to do. It's an authoritative approach that says, you know, disobedience isn't really an option here, but I'm not going to be mean about it, and I'm not going to argue with you, and I'm not going to negotiate.
Right.
And if I can do that, then the child learns in a gentle way that, well, to use a Star Trek phrase, resistance is futile. And eventually they learn that when mom or dad says something, they mean it, and they can make it happen. So, you know, we can do this the easy way or the hard way, but one way or the other is going to happen. And I haven't been mean about it. I haven't been hard-handed about it. I've just been authoritative about it. I asked you to do the thing. You didn't do the thing, so now I'm picking you up, and we're going to go do the thing.
Right.
You know, that's just one example. But we keep being surprised, for instance, that, well, my 3-year-old didn't follow through with that. Well, yeah, because 3-year-olds don't know how to listen and follow through.
It's almost as if you're in my house, Greg.
Well, you know, I mean, this is all of us. I mean, I've been there too, right? We all just fall prey to this thinking that again, if I just give my kid, you know, the right reasons and the best explanation or enough time to figure it out, they'll get it. But they don't. They have to learn that when mom and dad gives them options, you know, they have to pick from those options, and that's it. And also, you know, punishing them in those cases won't work because they don't understand why 3-year-olds, for example, can't connect actions and consequences. They have no idea why this bad thing is happening to them, just know that mommy and daddy are mad. You know, but if I'm able to say, hey, do this, and then when they don't do that, I pick up, well, that's all right. So I pick them up and I move them, and they do it. And it's like, wait a minute, how am I in this place doing this already? Oh, well, mom and dad made it happen. Okay,
right.
Well, now I know how this works. And I'm able to be a gentle parent, but still authoritative, where I'm not giving away my power, I'm not negotiating, I'm not resorting to crazy heavy-handed things and having this yelling, screaming fit with my 3-year-old, mm-hmm. where I'm acting like a 3-year-old too. I'm just making the thing happen.
And ultimately, every parent, especially as we grow ourselves in virtue and sanctification, all we want is for our children to live long and prosper. And so...
I see what you did there.
and so not only do we have to model that for them, being authoritative means that there are times when we'll have to, you know, pick them up and do the thing with them. And in the long run, that's what's going to be most beneficial for them.
That's right. Exactly. I mean, in another example, I mean, so, okay, it's time to pick up your toys. Well, no, I don't want to. It's like, okay, well, I understand. Like, you know, a lot of times it's hard to do the things we don't want to do.
Mm-hmm.
But then I, you know, go and I take my kid's hand and I put a toy in it. I walk them over to the toy box and I put the toy in the box. Do you want to do the next one yourself, or do you want me to still help you? You know, they're understanding this is going to happen. You know, I'm not arguing with you.
Yeah.
I'm not fighting with you. I'm not punishing you. It's just the thing I asked you to do is happening. And they learn then that when mom or dad makes a request, the thing is going to happen one way or the other, and they kind of come along with it. And again, I can still be gentle, I can be calm, I can be empathetic. You know, I totally get why you don't want to do this. There are a lot of things I don't want to do either. Okay, let's put the thing away. But I make it happen. And in that process, I'm actually teaching them to listen and follow through, which is not something that kids naturally come to.
Right.
They have to be walked through that structure. And that's the kind of thing we teach parents on Catholic Home all the time, and walk them through how to do it in a way that is gentle but still authoritative.
Right. Well, Greg, thank you so much for helping us boldly go where no one has gone before.
Just flogging that one, aren't you?
All right. My guest, Dr. Greg Popchak, he and his bride host, More to Life, and we've been talking about authoritative parenting and virtue. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
St. Joseph's Helper's mission is not only to repair homes for those in need, but to repair hearts by providing companionship and peace of mind, especially for veterans and the elderly. But they cannot meet the great needs of our community without volunteers like you. If you have the skills to complete small 2-hour home repair projects, to help in our office, or to be a prayer minister, visit sjhelpers.org today to let us know your availability. That's sjhelpers.org. St. Joseph's Helpers, giving dignity, spreading hope.
Support for this Ave Maria radio program comes in part by the non-for-profit St. Anthony Services. Are you shopping for mortgage products, Catholic investing, Catholic health, real estate, or estate planning? StAnthonyServices.org can help you find a Catholic professional for these needs. They regularly connect faithful citizens with faith-based professionals that share our Christian values. More information at StAnthonyServices.org or 877-LIFE-US1.
You like pizza? Me too. And for that, we can thank our friend, Tom Monahan. First, he starts with $900 and opens one pizza shop. Then it's worldwide, thousands of shops. But all this was just a warm-up for his greatest achievement yet. He built a university.
God inspired Tom to build up generations of men and women who have a hunger to reach the world for Christ. This place is Ave Maria University.
Visit avemaria.edu to see what's next.
People ask how they can care for older family members who can't fully care for themselves. One answer is Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care. Visiting Angels assists adults nationwide with 600 locations to continue living at home and not have to move into a nursing home. Their caregivers provide assistance in hygiene, meals, and light housework. Services are provided up to 24 hours per day, and you can select your caregiver before service begins. More information, including franchise opportunities, is on the web at visitingangels.com.
Good afternoon, welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. Today is a lot of things. We celebrate the Feast of the Annunciation of Gabriel to our Blessed Virgin Mother, but it's also the 30th anniversary of St. John Paul the Great's encyclical Evangelium Vitae, the Gospel of Life. This truly prophetic work has lost none of its intellectual vigor, deep wisdom, and also sobering calls. We take a closer look at it with Richard Spinello. Richard is professor of management practice at Boston College and a member of the adjunct faculty at St. John's Seminary in Boston. Richard, it's great to speak with you again. How are you?
Yeah, it's good to speak with you too. Yeah, it's been a little while, yeah, so I'm very glad to be back on your show.
I'm glad to be speaking with you as well. I always enjoy when you and I get to connect. It has been a while. I think it would be best, if we're going to talk about Evangelium Vitae, to talk about some of the historical contexts of the time when John Paul II wrote this. I mean, this was a time when he was reeling from society not listening to Humanae Vitae, and so this was his great response to it.
Yeah, I think that's correct. Yeah, of course, this was written, again, 30 years ago. It was released today on the Feast of the Annunciation, so it was written back in 1995. And certainly there was a lot of momentum for what he calls in there the culture of death. Abortion was on the rise.
Right.
So was euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide. These things were all becoming more widespread. And as you say, I think the church certainly, or people in the church, were not listening really to the message of Humanae Vitae, which complicates things. Because as he pointed out, in his opening chapters, there's a connection between the contraceptive mentality and abortion, because
yep.
In both cases you kind of see life as an enemy, So I think that's sort of the context of it. He was trying to sort of slow down the momentum of the rapidly scaling abortion culture. So that was his particular objective. And I think it also, it's important to note that it comes on the heels of Veritatis Splenda, which was another significant, that was written in 93. So that was another significant encyclical that kind of lays out the moral foundation for some of the teachings of Evangelium Vitae, because there he gets into moral theory a little bit more explicitly. So once he kind of lays that out, then I think he can take some of those moral principles and apply them to the life issues to abortion and euthanasia and so forth.
You know, you consider statements of public officials, Hillary Clinton, for example, in 2008, saying that we push for abortion because our intent is to make abortion, safe, legal, and rare. The fact of the matter is this was them creating a chink in the armor or a crack in the dam, because now we see that it is replete. It is almost a million children annually, if I'm remembering the numbers right. It's terrible. And John Paul II was warning us that if we don't respect the sexual gift, if we don't respect the bodily dignity of bride and bridegroom and marriage, there's no way we're going to respect and honor the life of the unborn. And he was completely right about it.
I think that's correct. I think so. A lot of the problems come from our misunderstanding of human sexuality. Mm-hmm. You know, we forget that the purpose of human sexuality is procreation. That's the way
right.
That's the very purpose of sex. That's the way God made things. And this sort of turns that whole God's wise design on its head. By saying, well, you know, procreation is the enemy, and we have to stop it. And if we can't stop it with contraception, then we'll stop it with abortion. So it all comes back to that very fundamental issue of what is the purpose of human sexual relationships, which is something that he wrote a great deal about, again, before Evangelium Vitae. So he wrote about it in Theology of the Body. He wrote about it in Love and Responsibility. There's all this great work that he produced that kind of addresses that particular issue, the purpose of human sexuality and the beauty of human sexuality, and the idea that life is a gift. You know, it's a fruit of these sexual relations.
And, yep.
people have to, if they engage in sexuality, they need to be married. They need to do it in a responsible way. But that's a message that has just fallen on deaf ears. I mean. And even for some in the church, it's fallen on deaf ears, which I think is unfortunate. So that's one of the reasons he wrote this and why we need to keep talking about it, because we haven't really solved these particular problems. They're probably worse now than they were back in 1995.
You know, you think about the fact that in 1995, when John Paul II wrote this, if I'm remembering correctly, I think... the year before, right? Yeah, it was the year before Time Magazine had named him Man of the Year. And then January of 1995, he had gone to Manila, and it was at that point in history the largest World Youth Day celebration ever. So he had the attention of the secular and the Catholic world when he published this. This document should have jarred all of the world into waking up and realizing that if we don't catch ourselves, this is where we're going. But we still didn't learn that lesson.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. You know, that he did have the attention of the world. He did have these huge crowds in Manila, 7 million people, I think, mm-hmm. attended his mass. I mean, just these phenomenal crowds. And you know, he was recognized as the one who would help to bring down the fall of communism. Mm-hmm. So he was very highly regarded. But the media didn't, if you go back and look at the media reception to this, it was very cool and apathetic. So that doesn't help matters, you know, particularly because he speaks in absolute terms. You know, he says, well, it's always wrong to deliberately, voluntarily kill an innocent human being.
Yep.
You know, the media doesn't, they don't like absolutes. They're scared by that, you know, the idea that someone would make these kind of statements, that something is always wrong, that there isn't some ambiguity and gray area. So it didn't get the best of receptions. I mean, I think there was some sympathy towards some of the things he was writing about. He does talk about how, you know, some of the problems associated with our disregard for life have to do with consumerism and so forth. They like that part of the message, but they have an aversion to these absolute moral principles that are part of the message. That it's, you know, it's always wrong to take innocent human life. So they were very critical, I think, of his of this encyclical when it came out, which I think was very unfortunate. It doesn't help a good reception when you have a kind of a hostile media.
Yeah.
Despite the fact, as you say, that he was so popular and had a strong position at the time.
Yeah. I think one of the reasons why that might have been, Richard, is there was this terrible tendency in the, you know, kind of the mid-60s into the 70s of rewriting legislation across the world, softening the language, especially when it comes to sexual morality and marriage and the family, no-fault divorce, all of that, right? And so when he comes out with this hard-hitting language on, you know, strong words on marriage and the family, one man, one woman, and about abortion and euthanasia, I can see politicians and people in power reeling from it, saying, okay, we're uncomfortable with the way he's referring to what we're trying to do.
Yeah, exactly, because it's so the message is so countercultural.
Yep.
You know, the culture is going one way, and he's going another way, you know, which is the right way. So it's always going to be hard when you're opposing the culture, but that's what Catholicism is. It is very countercultural. I mean, he talks about this actually in his one of his early books in 1978, Sign of Contradiction, where he says, you know, Jesus is, you know, to take in the words of the gospel, the sign of contradiction. And as Catholics, we're going to be signs of contradiction, too. And he was, as a pope, even though he was popular, he was a sign of contradiction. So he was going to stick to his guns and stick to the idea that marriage is always between a man and a woman, that life is always sacred, that you can't engage in abortion and euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide, that the purpose of sexuality is procreation. And as you know, these are unpopular positions in today's world, but they're the right positions. And he backs them up. I think Evangelium Vitae is not just an assertion of these things, but he digs pretty deep.
We have to stop there. My guest, Richard Spinello, we've been talking about the 30th anniversary of Evangelium Vitae. Stay tuned.
Resetting your password, unsubscribing from emails, printing anything. Why are simple things sometimes so complicated? Thankfully, with an auto owner's insurance independent agent, getting the right coverage for your business doesn't have to be one of them. So you can get back to more important things, like learning how that printer works. That's simple human sense.
Call Choice Insurance Agency at 734-641-4200.
St. Therese once told her sister Celine that when we trust ourselves and not God, our soul becomes barren and incapable of virtue. Her remedy? External works of charity. We all try to do it on our own sometimes without asking for God's help. At St. Paul Evangelization, we suggest sharing the gospel with someone who needs it. Check out streetevangelization.com to find a team near you where you can share the love of Jesus. If there isn't one in your area yet, perhaps God is calling you to start a team in your city. To learn more, visit streetevangelization.com.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria Mutual Funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria Mutual Funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria Mutual Funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
The most amazing saints from modern times, John Paul II, Maximilian Kolbe, and Maria Faustina with the Divine Mercy. This is Steve Ray. We invite you to join us on a pilgrimage to Poland and experience this incredible Catholic country, the land of saints, Catholic culture, gorgeous churches and shrines, and delicious food. Join us next April as we again visit Poland, one of our favorite pilgrimage destinations.
Find the Ave Maria Radio travel tab at AveMariaRadio.net.
I worked with a colleague who struggled to make decisions. She needed to seek out advice from dozens of people, often changing her mind based on the last person she talked to. It was frustrating. Proverbs shows us that seeking counsel can be beneficial. Without counsel, plans fail, but with many advisors, they succeed. But even with counsel, my colleague struggled to make a decision. Scripture shows us that indecision shows a lack of willingness to commit to absolute principles, and that sense, indecision is a weakness. And even if the decisions are not life-changing, we all can still benefit with prayer when making even the smallest and what seems like insignificant decisions. In the book of James, it explains that if we should pray in all situations, we should certainly pray in times of decision-making. As we pray, we ask for wisdom, then trust God for the best outcome. This has been a Christ Center communication message. I'm Vanessa Denha-Garmo, a communications evangelist.
Underwritten in part by the following nonprofit.
Are you paying high prices with a traditional health insurance company that pays for things that violate your conscience? There's an alternative available. Solidarity HealthShare is a community of faithful individuals and families that never share into immoral medical services, all while saving you money with prices starting as low as $85 per month for singles and $512 for families. Never fund another abortion with your healthcare dollars. Call 844-313-4999 to learn more.
Support for this Ave Maria radio program comes in part by the non-for-profit St. Anthony Services. Are you shopping for mortgage products, Catholic investing, Catholic help, real estate, or estate planning? StAnthonyServices.org can help you find a Catholic professional for these needs. They regularly connect faithful citizens with faith-based professionals that share our Christian values. More information at StAnthonyServices.org or 877-LIFE-US1.
Good afternoon. Welcome back. I'm Marcus Pisa. Once again, Blessed Feast Day of the Annunciation of the Angel Gabriel unto our Blessed Virgin Mother. As we dive deeper into contemplating the mystery of this event, I wanted to talk with an author of an intriguing book that I read some time ago. So this is Rachel Fulton Brown, and she's the author of Mary and the Art of Prayer, The Hours of the Virgin in Medieval Christian Life and Thought. Rachel is also Associate Professor of History at the University of Chicago. Rachel, it's great to speak with you. How are you?
It's lovely to be here. Thank you for having me.
Always a joy to reconnect with you. And I wanted to begin, there's so much to talk about and we have very little time, so I want to dive right into it with your treatment on the uniqueness and the liturgical appreciation of saying Ave Maria or Jerome's Ave Gratia Plena, really. The Ave and what that means for us as Christians.
Well, it's the moment of our greatest joy, because it's Mary's joy at the conception of her son. I'm happy that you read my book. I hope people are intrigued to delve into this mystery more fully. The book is actually on the hours of the Virgin. And in the liturgical tradition, the Ave Maria Gratia Plena is technically an antiphone. It's a chant sung at the beginning of the office. And it becomes for us in the tradition, sort of way of encapsulating that whole mystery of the hours in that one opening phrase. That's why we say with the Ave Maria Gratia Plena rather than strictly the Vulgate version of it without her name, because we're using it in its liturgical form,
right?
Which was if you're saying the hours of the Virgin, you're saying a series of psalms that she, thinking about her, frames the mystery of the incarnation. It frames the mystery of our Creator's entry into his creation. And the Ave Maria is that kind of frame, right? It's like, what kind of mystery is it to say, the Creator of heaven and earth entered into his creation through her, and in the hours of the Virgin, that whole mystery is beautifully contained. So I try to show that in the book, and it's a little bit of a long book, because when you start looking at each of these phrases, like, medieval Christians have whole meditations simply on Mary, her name, right?
The
Maria. You can do it as Jerome said of the meaning of her name, that it's the drop of the sea, by the later Middle Ages, that they're doing full meditations on every letter of the name. Bernardino de Busti, the Franciscan, has a whole meditation on what each of the letters mean. So it depends on how far you want to go in.
right. And so profound was the Church's meditation on the person of Mary that at least by the time of the medieval liturgical tradition and its development, it was very clear that, like you mentioned, down to the very letter, there was a real meditation on the personhood and the history of this woman. So much so that even in the writings of the Reformers and the early Protestants, it was very clear that Mary held a certain place of nobility and honor.
Yes, well, I've been working this last year on some articles on the Franciscan devotion to Mary, and the Franciscan devotion to Mary is very important for the saying of the Ave Maria as well, because I've said that it's the antiphon that introduces her hours. But it's also in the 13th century, the Franciscans developed the practice of saying it with at Vespers with the singing of the the ringing of the Angelus bell.
Mm-hmm.
And after they make that sort of recommendation for all of the brothers to preach to the laity, a number of Franciscans write whole commentaries just on the Ave Maria, just on, you know, just on the text. Conrad of Saxony is one. I go into some detail in my book about his meditation on mm-hmm. the words of the Ave. And then Servus Sanctus of Faenza is my favorite guy. I talk about him every chance I get. He writes an entire psalter of greetings, a psalter of creatures, you know, singing her praises, saying that it's 150 creatures, just like there are 150 grammatical elements in the angel's greeting to her. So it's a way of saying that the whole of creation is celebrating with her. To say that she's, you know, she's of both the royal family and the priestly family in the ancient understanding that, you know, Christ is both, you know, king and priest.
Mm-hmm.
These medieval devotions say, well, she's the window into our full contemplation of all of creation. It always gets bigger once you go through that portal for the medieval meditations.
You know, you opened up a biblical consideration that I know is going to be a can of worms. We can open it today and be done by next month at least. But this consideration of Mary's lineage, Mary's genealogy, and where she borrows her heritage, and the priestly and as well as the kingly. But even if we want to sidestep that consideration, just to talk about the medieval historical reality that you highlight, I'm drawn to, for example, people like Richard of St. Laurent, and the way he speaks about how we ought to utter, for example, the Ave Maria. For him, it wasn't just spiritual. Our entire bodies had to revolve around a certain piety in the expression of it.
Yes, and he's another of the 13th century commentators that I talk about in my book, and he has all of these, you know, instructions on how when you say the Ave Maria, you should be understanding yourself as like coming before our King and Queen, right? In fact, it's what the angel does when he comes into her, and in many of the paintings, right, that he kneels. So it's saying, like, what kind of physical response do you have? It's a physical event, the incarnation. So we should be thinking about, you know, this. So in all of my work, I wrestle with a lot of things about the way the modern Christians talk about Mary, including what happened with the 16th century and why they're wrong. the Catholics are right, but that's complicated, right? But the mystery of the incarnation is the marriage of humanity and divinity in
right.
her womb. And I think in modern Christians, just generally in modernity, we struggled a lot with that mystery. The 19th century becomes very, very interested in Jesus as a historical figure.
Right,
a similar sort of thing, saying Mary as a historical figure. So if you're worrying about why she's both priestly and kingly, well, modernity has put the cart before the horse in the problem, right?
Yeah.
She is priestly and kingly because that's what the Messiah is.
Mm-hmm.
And so it makes sense that she would be. And the earliest Christians, I mean, from antiquity everywhere, right? In Ethiopia and Syria and in Greek, the Latin tradition is actually later than all of these because it's, you know, they're translating from these Eastern languages. They're all completely convinced that she's the temple. She's the ark. She's the place where God becomes present.
Right.
And if you start worrying about, you know, whether she's priestly and kingly, well, you need to worry about who Jesus is. And you know, what he is the Messiah. He's the anointed one. He's, you know, God and, you know, the Word made flesh. God entered into history. Of course, she is going to be, you know, extraordinary and elevated and incomparable because he, you know, he's God,
yeah.
Right? And I think when we start quibbling over, like, how could she be this or how could she be that, it's like you got to start with the actual mystery, which is how could he be
mm-hmm.
our Lord and Savior? And then for the medieval meditation, it's sort of filling in all the blanks. It's like, well, if he's God and he becomes incarnate through her, that means she's the temple. You know, if he becomes incarnate through her, that means he becomes visible. So she's like a window through which the light enters into the world. So she, you know, she's the place where he becomes visible to us. Well, what kind of place would God become visible through? Oh, you know, the most beautiful creature ever created because he made her to be his mother.
Right.
And, you know, that we worry about how, you know, a poor, you know, nobody from, you know, the northern province in Rome, it's like you've got mystery backwards.
Right.
Why does God choose to become incarnate when and where he does? And then all of the other elements are, you know, aspects of the mystery to contemplate, but not historically the kind of problem that the 19th and 20th century like to make them.
That's right. And so that raises the concern about how we as people in modernity read the scriptures and think about these teachings, these doctrines in light of the empiricist worldview. Often Catholics are accused of anywhere from hyper-divinizing to mysticizing elements of the faith, when in reality we have the reverse problem. We don't mysticize and divinize enough. I'm talking with Rachel Fulton Brown, who is the author of Mary and the Art of Prayer, The Hours of the Virgin in Medieval Christian Life and Thought. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Today's programming on 990 WDEO is brought to you in part by Gifhamar Day Sponsor. The annual Rose Mass for Catholic healthcare workers celebrated by Bishop Boyer will be at 4:30 p.m. Saturday, March 29th at St. Thomas in Ann Arbor, followed by a dinner reception in the parish hall. Dr. Kristen Collier, Associate Professor of Internal Medicine at U of M, will speak on the importance of physician conscience in today's world. Suggested free will donation is $20. RSVP at cmalansing@gmail.com.
This program brought to you in part by Ave Maria Florida, a big kind of small town, where golf carts take you everywhere and there's always something fun around the corner. Discover championship golf, resort-style amenities, and a town center full of shopping and dining. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at its heart, it's a community full of connection and charm. More than 25 model homes are available for viewing. More information can be found at avemaria.com. That's avemaria.com.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
If you're still on the fence about purchasing a new air conditioner, just know that prices are expected to increase by 25% over the next year due to EPA standards. Don't wait.
Hi, I'm Ron Garmo with Running Right Heating and Cooling. Call us today for a free quote on a new air conditioning system and all your heating and cooling needs. Mention Ave Maria Radio and get a 10% discount.
Call today, 248-884-1704, or go to runningrighthvac.com to schedule an appointment.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchuk.
Do you ever wish you had more breaks from the daily demands of kids, chores, and work? Getting time for yourself is important, but a better way to stave off parental burnout is by examining how we manage our daily stress. Ask yourself this: are you able to ask for help from your family, or do you just passively, and maybe resentfully, meet everyone else's demands? Do you have routines that create a good flow in your day, or do you find yourself constantly running from one mini crisis to the next? The Liturgy of Domestic Church Life helps families create relationships, routines, and rituals that tame the craziness, make life easier on everyone, especially mom and dad. And when you do get a break, you'll be able to enjoy it more, too. To learn more about the Liturgy of Domestic Church Life, check out our books, Parenting Your Kids with Grace and Parenting Your Teens and Tweens with Grace, or visit CatholicHOM.com. I'm Dr. Greg Popchuk, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
No one should ever have to choose between feeding their family and keeping their heat on. Impossible questions like rent or diapers demand answers every day, likely in your very own neighborhood, but you can help. Hope Clinic partners with you to provide free medical, dental, food, and behavioral health care, all in Jesus' name. While others face impossible choices, your choice is an easy one. Partner with Hope Clinic today. Find out how at www.thehopeclinic.org.
You like pizza? Me too. And for that, we can thank our friend Tom Monahan. First, he starts with $900 and opens one pizza shop. Then it's worldwide, thousands of shops. But all this was just a warm-up for his greatest achievement yet. He built a university.
God inspired Tom to build up generations of men and women who have a hunger to reach the world for Christ. This place is Ave Maria University.
Visit avemaria.edu to see what's next.
Good afternoon, welcome back. Marcus Peter. Once again, a blessed feast of the Annunciation of Gabriel to our Blessed Virgin Mother. I'm speaking with Rachel Fulton Brown, Associate Professor of History at the University of Chicago, about, at least we're trying to focus on the medieval appreciation and liturgical appreciation of Mary, and in this case her fiat and the Annunciation event proper. But really there's a grander concern that's been brought into play. And Rachel, You brought this up, and I tried to touch on it just before the break, which is our modern empiricist sensibilities simply don't allow us the more expansive reality of viewing biblical typology in its truly mystical, elevated perspective. So just comment on that in terms of how we ought to start thinking about Mary rightly when we look at the scriptures.
So I think if we're thinking about the Annunciation, one way to help people start is think about the angel. and say, it's like I did a whole class at the University of Chicago on angels and demons, and you know, realizing that they're hard to talk about because they are, you know, they're creatures like we are, but they have no bodies, right? They have their intellect, their pure intellect. And yet somehow, in the story, it's like the angel comes to Mary. How? What does it mean for a messenger? You know, the strength of God. Gabriel's name means strength of God, right? Mm-hmm. What does that mean for the angel to come to Mary? And then he kneels to her because in recognition of her being chosen to be the queen of the angels, right? There's this mystery of her coronation in the medieval iconography where she's elevated to the throne and crowned after death. And therefore, she's become queen of angels. The Franciscans are very interested in her as this mystery too. That they recognize her as the queen of the angels. That's why Los Angeles has that name, the angels. It's Mary, mm-hmm. Queen of Heaven, Queen of Angels. And so the sense of like, what does it mean to be in a world that is heaven joined with earth somehow? Right, the angels come from heaven. Gabriel appears to her somehow. There's always wonderful paintings about saying what would it, you know, be like for her to be suddenly met with the glory of God, right, in this moment of the messenger comes to her, whether he's the magnificent winged creature of the Renaissance paintings or just a beam of light, right? It's like what he enters into her, and that he is in fact part of the battle line of you know, the hosts of heaven. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at Bede's homily on the passage that we're thinking about today. And he has this description of Gabriel as the prophet said in this in the psalm, the Lord strong and powerful, the Lord powerful in battle. That battle undoubtedly in which he, Christ, came to fight the powers of the air and to snatch the world from their tyranny. This is what Gabriel is, right? He's one of the angels that comes in that battle. And the angel comes to Mary to, you know, announce, in fact, our victory in that moment, that the hosts of heaven with her will, you know, show us the truth of our Creator. And I can't stop talking about that enough, because I think the empirical meditation on Jesus as the human, you know, in his human visibility, which is easy to show in movies and, you know, write in novels and things like that. Mm-hmm. The problem for medieval Christians was always, this is God you're talking about. Exactly what does that mean?
Right.
And so if you read their meditations, it's always starting from, it's God the Creator who somehow enters into our historical reality, not the opposite way, which is the, you know, the 19th, 20th century. It's not only empiricist, it's euhemerist. Mm-hmm. It's the assumption that we've taken human beings, and, you know, who were great, you know, characters like Alexander the Great or Julius Caesar or something, and divinized them. And that's not what the Christian mystery is. The Christian mystery is our Creator became human and suffered and died. So, you know, the humility of Mary's humility is mirroring the emptying himself and entering into her. And again, I'd say, you know, modern feminism tends to worry about, when, you know, oh, Mary's so humble. It's like, you don't get it.
Right.
What the mystery here is that God has emptied himself to enter into our suffering, and she's going to suffer with him, right? It's not just joy, yes, and power. It's, you know, the cross. So, and it's appropriate that, you know, the Annunciation as a feast typically falls in Lent, because it's part of that mystery too.
If I may expand that conversation, and you being a woman would lend greater credence to this conversation as well, that what radical feminism has done as it pertains to the image of the woman is, when you juxtapose it with the figure of Mary, it finds the figure of Mary almost repulsive, because her fiat is so entire, so complete, because her humility is so manifest. And yet, what I would argue, what the church has always argued, is that is what makes manifest the true strength of womanhood, her submissiveness before the will of God, and that's what makes Mary the highest of the created saints.
So one of the other great mysteries that the ancient and medieval tradition always keeps in view is that Mary is the obverse of Eve.
Mm.
that Eve, you know, is disobedient and Mary is obedient. And that goes back to Irenaeus and his description of, you know, the sort of great mystery that Mary's participating in. But this, I mean, this is a challenge for, it's not just for women, it's a challenge for all human beings. But,
right,
you know, women, we struggle with this in particular ways. You all want to be the girl boss, right? you all want to have the power, and you all want to, you know, be able to be like gods. I mean, this is literally in the story in Genesis, that what the serpent promised to Eve was, you will be like gods. You will see and know everything. You will have power.
Right.
And I mean, we've learned, I think quite vividly in recent times, because of the new kinds of powers that our internet connection gives us, this desire to be in control of everything. You know, I'm going to control people, other people's speech. I'm going to control the way they behave socially. And I say this as a woman, one of our great temptations is to want to be in control of the social situation.
Mm.
In some ways we're really good at it. We can, you know, we can change the social situation quite quickly with a single word. Mary understood that, right? Her fiat is this, you know, it's the surrender to God. I mean, that's really the highest surrender you could make.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a recognition of, you know, being made, being a creature, being made to, you know, be made in the image and likeness of God. There's also lovely medieval meditations on how she looks just like Christ. She's so perfectly mirroring him that she looks just like him. So she becomes most like Christ in her submission, her humility, her submission. For women, she also becomes a very important focus for us, because if we focus on her, and she's our queen, and she's, you know, in fact, loves all of us, takes care of all of us. I've regularly meditated on this. Mary wants all women to be absolutely as beautiful as she is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, talk about humility, right? Women are often, you know, we're worrying about ranking each other. She, you know, better me. And we do it, ladies. Don't deny it. and Mary is saying, it's like, you are all beautiful. You were all souls made in the image and likeness of God. The more you become yourself in that truth, the more beautiful you are. And I do think, you know, medieval women seem to have understood this in their relationship with her. Their relationship with her is different from men's relationship with her, and that's significant and important. But she teaches us to all be lifted up as sisters in Christ. And I have a huge lifelong quarrel with the way feminism has distorted that blessing.
Right. And so when we re-pivot then to the considerations of people like Bede, like you read earlier, I was just thinking about everything you just said in light of what Bede writes. And now, mind you, it's not just him. By the medieval era especially, this contemplation of a very reverential read of Mary and womanhood, and therefore this typological reality that shows up in the scriptures, it's just palpable. There's a real sense of loving reverence about how womanhood, and especially Mary's womanhood, is written about.
Mm-hmm. What's interesting is so she's you know, the place where God becomes present, that people like Servius Sanctus and Richard, all of them, right? The 13th century was filled with people that enjoyed thinking in these metaphors. There's several that are quite critical for her. The Ark is one of them. And I've mentioned the Ethiopian devotion to her. They believe that they have the Ark of the Covenant, the actual relic, but they're also very devoted to Mary as the Ark of the Covenant. So she's the Ark because she's the place of the presence. She's the temple. They talk about that. She's the bedchamber. I mean, it's like the bridegroom, you know, weds humanity and divinity in her womb. So they have, you know, beautiful meditations on how beautifully ornamented she is with jewels and fabrics and things like that as a bedchamber. This is all to say, I mean, I think if you think about that's what pregnancy is. It's, you know, she's a container for God, right? But, you know, women as mothers, we're the container of life.
You're right.
How is that not like the most, you know, beautifully mind-blowing gift we could possibly be given, that you are the place where God works, you know, his craftsmanship in bringing forth human beings? She gives us this extraordinary understanding of what it is to be human, what it is to be a soul made in the image and likeness, what it is to be made by a creator who loves his artifacts.
Mm-hmm.
He loves, you know, how beautiful he's made all of his creatures. And we women are a particular form of that creation, which is the one in which he does his most precious work.
Right.
I think it helps men in their devotion to her because their service to her shows, you know, the true reverence for life, right? They dedicate themselves to her both as knights in her service, but also, I mean, Bede has an amazing. Do I have time?
No, unfortunately, we have to wrap up. Rachel, I always enjoy it when
we
connect.
Well, it's amazing meditation on Joseph, but anyway.
And Rachel, we will talk again in the future. Thank you so much. My guest, Rachel Fulton Brown, and we've just had this truly enlightening conversation about Mary and the art of prayer and how the medievals understood Mary. Thank you for joining us. Happy Feast Day. Until next time, I'm Marcus Peter.